RN is also a great read. Find feature articles online at our homepage.
And hello, a warm welcome to Life Matters. Natasha Mitchell joining you now on RN. Terrific to have your company for the next hour of your day. Fear and its flip side, optimism, both stars of the show today. Bob Brown is our guest for the whole second half hour of the show, getting very personal with us this morning, as he does in a new memoir. Optimism is its title. He wasn't always that way, though, as you'll hear. So what changed? What changed indeed? You can tweet us at RN Life Matters, and our listener feedback line is 02 833 1430. Fear can have a powerful effect on our behaviour, can't it? It can hold us back. It can constrain us. It can contain us. Here's the thing, though. It can also motivate us to buy more. What's that all about? In the final episode of the Consumer Psychology series, Talking Shop, our hosts with the most, Kirsten Drysdale and Dr. Paul Harrison, are taking a look at how fear is used in the marketing arsenal.
Nice hair.
Louis the Fly.
I use the most expensive hair color in the world because I'm worth it.
Now repeat after me. Oils is oils.
No. Oils eat oils.
Hope you've got a healthy appetite.
Yeah, right.
I'd like a whole grain cereal, nothing too heavy.
Uh-huh.
Or light.
The slogan.
Hey. Those bodies.
The hairspray that leaves hair feeling like hair.
Matter of fact, I got it now.
Sick of Rex.
Hello and welcome to the final episode of Talking Shop, a series where we've been joyriding through the annals of consumer psychology and behaviour to get to the bottom of why you buy what you buy and, in a, we hope, not altogether futile effort, to help you buy better. I'm Kirsten Drysdale and I'm joined, as always, by Dr. Paul Harrison, our resident consumer behaviour sensei.
It's been a pleasure to be yours and our listeners, sensei Kirsten-san.
It's just that you're so very zen about all this marketing manipulation.
I learned a long time ago to be like a duck.
Ah, stay calm on the surface. Yes. Okay. Well, look, today's episode is all about how fear is used to get us to buy things. So zenness is probably the perfect character trait for this topic. Let's start with an ad from Kotex for one of the most terrifying thoughts of all, groin sweat patches.
89% of you say sweat is good. 81% say sweat patches are not. You buy Kotex Sportliners are specifically designed for sport, with a sweat-dry core to help wick away moisture. So you can sweat without sweating it. Grab your free sample at You Buy Kotex.
Oh my God, women sweat?
Like pigs, Paul.
But hang on, my understanding is that pigs don't actually sweat very much at all.
Exactly. But that ad, which showed a number of women being mortified by the appearance of sweat patches in their groin region while exercising, would have you believe that these sweat patches are A, a common problem, and B, so humiliating that the only way to avoid them is to buy Kotex sports liners.
Well, it is a textbook approach. The simplified consumer behaviour model that we use in marketing starts with this idea of identifying a problem and then perhaps accentuating it. So that's all that Kotex have done. They've taken something that may not really be an issue for most people, particularly people at the gym, and turned it into a problem that can be solved with a product that they just happen to make.
Frankly, I think they've made this one up entirely. But Paul, you do know quite a bit about this tactic, and you actually made a great short film about it. And before we hear a bit from there, could you tell us a bit about the story behind the film?
So I was researching the psychology of in-home sales. So this is a little bit different from door-to-door sales in that the sales salesperson uses a series of tactics over time. So they might initially offer you some kind of prize for your contact details.
Okay. So now is that like where there's a win a car at the shopping centre if you sign up and give us your name and number?
Yeah, exactly. And another technique they used was to have these forms in fish and chip shops. So, okay. You know, very benign. Then they'd contact you for a visit by a representative, what they call the representative, and then they'd visit you and undertake what ended up really being a sales pitch.
Right. Okay. Now let's play a bit from Shutting the Gates, which is the name of the film. And these are all direct quotes from these salespeople, right?
Yep, yep. And for this particular product, which is maths software, the salespeople first of all create a huge amount of fear amongst parents when they don't feel like they're in control of their child's education. So the script that these salesmen had to learn, so they had a script, was very orchestrated, and it was all about gaining initially the parents' trust. And so the clip starts with the salesman talking to the camera, and then we hear him talking to the parents.
The first part of this presentation is kind of build the anxiety in the first part.
It's a little bit like laying bricks to build a wall. We're missing a couple of bricks. Those two missing bricks are going to affect the learning year by year as we go on.
It's kind of build the need.
And you want her to reach her potential, that's right?
Of course.
Yeah, we do.
Okay. And the second part is when you come in and you solve the anxiety.
He started filling out the forms and basically I just went, yeah, sign me up.
The sales routine is, as we were trained, is what's known as the sheep paddock. Moving people through the gates, closing them behind them, till the only gate left open is the one I'm offering. The only gate left open is the one where you buy the product.
Okay, now, Paul, this idea of marketers inventing a problem and creating a product or service to solve that problem isn't new, and a lot of us are sort of literate consumers who understand that much these days, but that clip provides us with a very acute example of how our decision-making process changes when we're in an anxious frame of mind.
Yeah, one way to think about it is to ask how we make choices when we're fearful. So George Lowenstein, who's a researcher from Carnegie Mellon University, first talked about choice under uncertainty to be an issue about how people feel as opposed to how they think about their choice at the moment of decision-making. Mm-hmm. He called it the risk as feelings hypothesis, in that it's our emotional reactions that often drive behaviour rather than some calculated, thoughtful decision-making process.
So at the very moment when that woman is sitting right there in her house with the salesman next to her at the dining room table thinking about her child not getting a good education, she's not really weighing up what he's offering her in a rational way.
Nope, not at all. And we often allow our immediate emotional response, that visceral response, to influence how we even cognitively assess it. So, for example, if I'm worried about ageing, which I'm not...
No, neither am I.
Of course not. I'm more likely to evaluate how I emotionally feel about it than whether it's a rational thing for me to be worried about. And that's why they show men's moisturiser advertisements during the football on TV.
And presumably also why they show the KFC bucket when a try is scored?
No, that's just dumb sponsorship.
Is it though? Because I've heard from people who are way too smart to fall for it and actually have gone and bought a KFC bucket because they saw it on the ad.
Really?
Yeah.
Was KFC near their house?
No, I don't think it would have been, and I'm not going to name names, but they did work on the Gruen transfer once, so they should have known better.
Okay,
so there's being scared into buying things because marketers create hypothetical scenarios that we want to avoid, but there's also some more recent research around what's called incidental fear. That is a sense of fear that actually has nothing to do with the message a brand or product is trying to convey, but which actually enhances emotional brand attachment in a brand. Now, I thought advertisers were supposed to avoid associating their products with negative emotions like fear.
Yeah, there's some different perspectives on this. Probably the best way to think about this is that heightened emotions all tend to create an environment where the emotion becomes associated with whatever other information is happening being processed at the same time. So if I'm watching a horror movie and I'm scared, and if the brand is incorporated into the film, then my memory tends to associate that heightened emotional response, but not necessarily the specific fear response, with that brand.
Does this mean shop assistants are going to start start sneaking up behind us to give us a fright?
Probably not, but I do know that David Jones is in trouble, so maybe it's worth considering.
It's the way out.
Mm-hmm. And another study published just last month went a bit deeper and found that people who experienced fear, and in this case they were watching films like The Ring and Salem's Lot, felt a greater emotional attachment to a brand of soft drink. I mean, the researchers argued that this was because fear creates a motivation to form an attachment to something. In this case, sadly, a brand of soft drink.
Oh, it's nowhere near as cuddly as an old teddy bear.
I do wonder if you can cuddle a brand. The attachment to the brand in relative terms, though, was quite weak. It's statistically significant for anyone who's interested in the stats, while the sad, happy and excited conditions didn't have any effect at all.
Right, so fear trumps all.
Yeah, it's a survival thing.
Sort of like the bonding that can happen between people who go through very stressful situations together, like natural disasters or terrorist attacks.
Yep, and plenty of research in psychology has shown that the greater the threat, the greater the person's tendency to want to affiliate with people that they perceive to be like them, and perceive is the operative word here.
All right. Now, although this research around incidental fear and brand attachment has only come out very recently, it seems Doritos had a bit of foresight when they ran a campaign a few years ago called Hotel 626. Now, this was an online virtual reality game set in a haunted hotel targeted at teenagers. So let's hear a little bit from it.
When Doritos brought back two flavors from the dead, something dark came back with them. Everything's scarier at night. That's why Hotel 626 is only open from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. You're living a nightmare in a 3D world never before seen in a website. And you have to do whatever it takes. Like taking a picture of a psychopathic baby, singing a demon baby to sleep, and making it out of a madman's cell.
You made it out, but we'll see you again in the darkness.
So, as you could probably tell by the sound effects, it was an immersive horror movie experience. And according to the creators of the campaign, the site fostered greater participation by enabling a webcam to trigger head tracking technology so that you can dodge left and right, avoiding the frenzied lunges of a chainsaw-wielding attacker. A picture is also taken of your face, and using distortion mapping, later shows you as a reflection in a sink of dirty water.
Oh my goodness. And it was an incredibly successful campaign, and it was designed to completely bypass parents.
And it was legitimately scary if you actually played the game.
Yep.
And what I find quite interesting about all of this, Paul, is that the campaign was considered a huge success. They sold out of these new Back from the Dead flavors. More than 4 million people in 136 countries played the game. It won the Cyber Lion Award at the Cannes Marketing Awards in 2009. But at no time within the game do you see the products, the packets of Doritos chips anywhere.
And I think the fact that the brand wasn't mentioned was a critical part of the campaign. So teenagers are desperately trying to create their own identity. So while they're having a blast freaking themselves out in this game, their unconscious brains were seeking out more information about the game and who was promoting it. They weren't necessarily conscious that their brains were making all of these connections, but because of what we know about fear, they were more receptive to information about the brand and were more likely to be forming an attachment to the brand.
Right. And they actually did end up using Doritos products in the sequel to Hotel 626. This time it was a game called Asylum 626. And for Asylum 626, to access the final scene of the game, you had to hold up a special code that was printed on bags of Doritos to the webcam.
Yeah, it's clever. And it means then that the people had to buy the Doritos and eat the Doritos and even then further cement that experience with their heightened emotional state.
This is Talking Shop with Kirsten Drysdale.
And Paul Harrison.
And we've been talking about how fear is used by marketers to get us to buy things. But in all fairness, we should also talk about how fear can be used to pressure us into doing things that are actually good for us, like getting tested for kidney disease, avoiding unprotected sex, or choosing sunblock over a plain moisturiser.
Oh man, this is a real Pandora's box. There are a couple of different perspectives around whether fear actually works in changing behaviour, especially in areas where we see a lot of fear campaigns like quitting smoking and eating healthily. So some research actually suggests that fear in these types of campaigns creates a flea response. So what that means is that often the target market for these campaigns actually create psychological defences so that they can ignore the message.
Right, a little bit like, all right, if you're going to tell me I'm going to die, I'm going to run away.
Yeah, yeah. But a recent paper in the Journal of Consumer Research called Depletion Heightens Self-Protective Behaviour in the Face of Danger...
Catchy.
...suggested that fear can work for good under certain conditions.
Well, I think we're going to need a little lesson in what that word depletion means, Paul. Can you help us out?
Sure. So it's well established in psychology that people have limited resources to manage self-control, to resist those kind of impulsive or implicit responses. And when our energy to resist is depleted, then we have less self-control. And depletion can be something as benign as being given a simple mathematical task, being given too many choices, going for a run, noisy environments like shopping centres, resisting eating food that you know isn't good for you, or even just being tired.
Okay, so anytime you're a little bit distracted or overwhelmed in some way, whether it's screaming kids or loud music, whatever it is, you are depleted.
Yes, and depletion begets depletion. So the more you try to resist something, the less resources you have to continue to resist it and other impulses. One really interesting study found that athletes performed worse after they'd been given a mathematical task. So it affects mental and physical effort.
I hope they weren't mathletes. All right, so that's the sort of psychological state these researchers induced in people before running these experiments to see what happened, to see whether they'd engage in self-protective behaviours. And what did happen?
Well, in the research, they found that the depleted participants as opposed to the non-depleted participants...
Okay, so that's the worn-down people versus the fresh people.
Yes, were less likely to engage in risky behaviours like having unprotected sex and more likely to engage in risk reduction behaviours like getting tested for chlamydia or kidney disease.
Right, so wearing them down and letting the impulsive response take over actually resulted in good decisions.
In this particular case, and there's research in neurology that actually supports this in that the depletion shifts the regulatory balance away from the frontal regions where all of the processing, the executive functions go on, to the left amygdala, which is the part of the brain that's involved in detecting danger and self-protection.
All right, let me try to translate that. When you are a bit overwhelmed, you're less likely to make decisions using the sensible calculator part of your brain and more likely to use the instinctive, don't let the lion eat you, part of the brain.
Exactly. But there are some caveats, the most important being that it wouldn't work in situations where there are other forces competing with the appropriate behaviour. So, for example, it probably wouldn't work if you're trying to get people to quit smoking.
Is that because so much of smoking behaviour is about, like, the social pressure to fit in?
Yeah, and in that situation, the key self-protection mechanism is more related to protecting the social self rather than the relatively abstract personal health self.
Right, so it's about self-protection in a sense.
Yeah.
All right, so in short, fear is a really great way of targeting our impulsive responses, and this can be used for good reasons, like making us get a health check, or it can be used for reasons like making us buy more Doritos. This has been the final episode of Talking Shop with Kirsten Drysdale and Dr. Paul Harrison from Deakin University.
To use the name my kids call me.
All about how fear is used to encourage us to buy things. Now, we don't want to leave you feeling too terrified though, do we, Paul?
Is it at all reassuring to say that this is a well-practiced deceit by marketers?
No, not really.
Well, they've been doing it for a really long time to sell us all sorts of products like antibacterial soap, permeate-free milk,
deodorant, fat-free lollies, vitamins,
four-wheel drives, mouthwash, sports drinks, even politicians. The list is endless.
And you might think you're immune to all of this, that you're sensible, you don't fall for those tricks, but the evidence shows that we all do. Even the most rational among us are prone to letting our emotions rule our wallets.
I mean, if you listen to the marketers, you'd probably come to the conclusion that the world is a very scary place.
So before you buy anything, take a deep breath, relax, look around you, see there's no lion coming after you, and ask yourself, is this something I really need or want to pay for?
Give yourself some time. Don't always go with your immediate emotional response.
But don't always ignore your emotions and intuition.
Because sometimes the best experiences can come out of spontaneity.
Straightforward as ever. Well, that's it for Talking Shop. We hope you've enjoyed the series. If you've missed any episodes, you can download them on the RN website, where there's also a bunch of articles to go with each one. Thanks again, Paul, for all your expert advice.
And thanks to you too, Kirsten. It's been lots of fun.
So long and shop well.
What a stirring end to Talking Shop. Fantastic series. Thank you to Kirsten Drysdale from The Checkout on ABC Television, of course, and Dr. Paul Harrison from Deakin University. And as they said, all six episodes and great feature articles by both of them. You can get to that from the RN homepage. Just look for Talking Shop. Speaking of other great series landing on the network, be sure to tune in to Animal People on Sundays at the moment at 5:30 or podcast at a great exploration by Sarah Lestrange into our relationship to other animals. We are animal people, after all. I think our next guest is an animal person of sorts. Stay tuned.
My father had a special rifle.
Amelia will perform her piece from memory.
Cup of tea went to his mouth and he said, help me, and it was all over, which was sad at the time, but the best way to do it.
Rabbits, violins and mousetraps. Take a closer listen. Radiotonic at the RN homepage.
It's not easy being green, sung Kermit the Frog, and that chorus line gets a mention in my next guest's new memoir today. Bob Brown needs no introduction, but I can bet you didn't know that he first took a stand over a green patch and was jailed for it when he was just six. As a senator and the founding leader of the Australian Greens, he is one of our best-known political figures. A medical doctor, Bob came to politics with a reputation for action. In the 80s, of course, he was a key driver of that large and successful campaign to stop the Franklin Dam. That campaign led him on into the Tasmanian Parliament and from there into the Senate. For 16 years, the Franklin protest cost him 17 days in jail. He was in jail again a decade later when he stood in front of bulldozers to save the Tarkine wilderness. He's now retired from politics. He's just penned a memoir called Optimism, Reflections on a Life of Action. We nearly lost him in Melbourne traffic this morning, but we have nailed him to the studio chair. Welcome to Life Matters, Bob.
Good morning, Natasha.
We lost you there for a moment.
Yes, got caught up in a bit of Melbourne traffic.
A bit of urban wilderness. Yes. What was that green patch that you took a stand for at age six and got jailed for by your father?
Well, it was his organic spinach, which my mother dished up with the roast dinner at Trunkie Creek out there on the old coaching road between Bathurst and Goulburn. He was the local police constable, and I took a stand on the repugnant stuff. And he got me by the collar and took me up to the wooden cells, which had seen some very notable miscreants in its time. And I was left there. I can remember the iron bolt shooting home and darkness for half an hour to consider my rebellion. And as I told him later in life, he was a great father, but I told him later it was cruel and unusual punishment because when I came out, Natasha, he took me straight back down to the kitchen and there was the
spinach now cold
and I had to eat it anyway. It was followed up by my mother's sweets, so it ended up okay.
I had a similar battle over a plate of spinach with my father. Mind you, I didn't end up in jail. He wasn't an overly punitive man in your life, though, despite that incident.
No, oh, not at all. In fact, I'm glad of the, you know, the firm hand that he had. I learned a lot from him, and it was to hold me in good stead through some big trials and tribulations later on. But he didn't suffer fools gladly. He didn't. He did the best he could to make sure if somebody got into trouble. And could recover from that, the book wasn't thrown at them. On the other hand, I remember a magistrate, I think it was, him pulling up a car and the magistrate saying, "I'm the local magistrate, constable so-and-so." And my father said, "Well, thank you very much for telling me. Here's your ticket." And he just had common sense, and I'm glad of that.
What about, how did your mother, Marjorie May, and your father, Jack Henry Brown, react when you landed in jail for real during the Franklin Dam protests? You include a very jolly letter to them from prison in 1982 in the book, where the food is great. You're having quite a lovely time, it seemed.
Yeah, the saveloys were good and the corned beef. Look, he was a policeman and he... it was hard for them. He wanted me to be back in the medical practice and earning a living and doing what doctors did. So here I was in jail. But by the same token, my mother said they'd always voted Liberal. There's a secret. He got up and wrote to the Prime Minister of the day and said, anybody who puts a hand on a son of mine has lost it with me. I'm finished with you. So blood runs thicker than water, and love of family was something that saved me through some pretty tough times when I was younger, and is something I value greatly now. I had excellent parents. They'd had their own trials and tribulations in their life before me. I've got great siblings, and I'm very happy with that, and the friends I've had through life. And I write a little bit about that, but the book, as you know, is about wonderful people I've met in life, extraordinary people, some of whom have been in terrifying situations, like Ingrid Betancourt, who was chained by the neck to a tree in the Amazonian jungle for months after she tried to escape from people who kidnapped her as a senator, a Green senator in Colombia, at gunpoint. And she's now... I knew her before. I know her now. She's studying liberation theology at Oxford University.
But, is that so? Totally, I didn't know that. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, and just an inspiring, strong-willed and very compassionate human being.
You start this book by acknowledging that, in fact, you spent a chunk of your early years in life very depressed and deeply pessimistic. What was that in response to, given that you've called this book Optimism?
Well, really, it was a clash of... I was a Presbyterian and young Christian fellow and had seen the sign in St. Paul's Presbyterian Sunday School in Armidale saying God is love, but at the same time I was realising I was homosexual. And according to the St. Paul's, the scribe in the Bible, homosexuals should be put to death. And in fact, there was a 20-year penalty for people involved in homosexuality at that time. And it was something you just couldn't talk about. One of the great things in my lifetime, Natasha, has been the change away from that punitive attitude towards gay men and women, and we're still seeing that play out. We haven't made it yet, but at least we're not in Iran.
You knew at 12. You've had a very clear feeling at 12, and I wonder what that then... The word gay wasn't part of your lingo then, but I wonder what that realisation meant for you at Blacktown Boys High when you ended up there.
Well, yeah, and I became school captain by default. I shouldn't have been. The headmaster imposed that after the boy who was elected, he knocked out. And I was, I was terrified because I'd been subject to some sexual abuse by a teacher earlier on, and that was potentially on the public record. And of course, it was a great feeling of shame and internal hemorrhage. And so that's why I sought, both through religion, it didn't work. The prayers didn't make any difference to my sexuality. So I tried the medical course later on and got some testosterone injections, and later on had aversion therapy, which is electrical shock against the visage of a naked male and a nice fresh glass of water with the visage of a naked female. I mean,
so you subjected yourself to that. That must have come from a very deep place, a sort of deep misery to put yourself through aversion therapy.
Exactly. And it was a desperate effort to try to be, and I put this very much in quotes, normal. What I realised later on, and I ran into this magnificent young psychologist when I did go to London after considering suicide, that he said, Bob, why don't you be yourself? You know, you're gay. Take it and enjoy it. And as I say in the book, that wasn't psychotherapy, it was psychosanity. It took some years later because of the entrapment society imposes through homophobia on people who are homosexual. It took some time for that to work its way out. But
it was finally the Franklin River that set you free, you suggest.
Yeah, I ran into Paul Smith, who was a forester, and he asked me if I'd go down the Franklin, and I knew that would take a couple of weeks. I said yes. He couldn't find anybody else who was silly enough to in those days. It was a wild river, uncharted country, and people simply didn't go rafting. And by the way, that river's now classed as the world's top whitewater adventure. He asked me to go. I went with him, but I knew inevitably when you go off for a couple of weeks into the bush with somebody, you get to talk about very personal things. So I wanted to tell him first, and I did. And he laughed. He said he was a trout fisherman. He said, "Well, Bob, I'm not homosexual." And I knew that he had a wife and a couple of kids. Mm. But he said, "I can tell a good-looking man like I can tell a good-looking trout," and I had a laugh too.
That's classic. The Lonnie Times, the Launceston Times, didn't respond in quite the same way, did they?
Well, the Launceston Examiner came out after when I came back. He urged me to go public. It was a terrifying experience, but I did. I went on to an ABC TV program. I wince when I look at that.
One way to do it.
Now. Yeah, but once the genie was out of the bottle, it was out. And the Examiner came out to do a story on it, and the journalist was very good about it, but I didn't want to, you know, and I wouldn't line up for a picture, and there's a pretty awful picture on the front under the heading, "Doctor Says He's Gay."
Capital letters, front page.
Yeah, and I had to go back into the surgery later that week for my a three-day stint in the surgery, and I had to go back to the Launceston Walking Club. And what was really, and I went to the local neighbours who were good Baptist folk and knocked on their doors and said, "Hey, I'm Bob," you know, they all knew I was Bob, "I'm homosexual." And they were good about it. You know, one wife said to her husband, "Oh, we think we've got an uncle like that, haven't we?" But it was, you know, this was a topic that couldn't be discussed. Mm. And I was putting a burden on them, and I was aware of it, and I had to fly to the mainland and see my family, who were just terrific about it. And there was some relief all around. But the tirades began then, and it took decades for me to now be able to know that if somebody comes up to me to talk about sexuality, they're coming up to say, "Good on you, Bob."
Screaming out from a passing car. Their anger about you and your policies got wrapped up in homophobia. We might get back to that. Thinking about the values that drive you, Bob Brown. For example, the British philosopher Bertrand Russell and the Italian philosopher Machiavelli both get repeat mentions in this memoir, and I'm wondering how they've informed your thinking or understanding about the way the world works.
Well, Machiavelli, of course, was just as simply a psychologist of how human politics works, and particularly said, if you want to change the world, get ready to be crushed by those who've already got the power and the money. But for Bertrand Russell, I read his book, A History of Western Philosophy, in the 70s, and it really struck a chord with me. The travail of people down through the century, like the great philosopher and mathematician Hypatia, who in the 4th century in Alexandria was dragged through the streets by the then rising and proselytizing Christian Saint Cecil, who, and she was cut up with razor blades and to bits for simply being a pragmatist and talking about the world as she saw it. And I, when I read all this and the horrific things that had happened to other people, I felt much easier about the circumstances I was in. In fact, I felt inspired by the terrible things that happened to other people. But Russell said, and I quoted in the introduction, the trouble with the world is that the stupid people are cocksure and intelligent people are full of self-doubt. How true that is. Mm. And the people who are thoughtful about the world and compassionate have got to get over that self-doubt and get active. And the best way to get active is by taking on optimism. Pessimism knocks you out. Optimism gets you going. And I spent 10 years pessimistic and down the dumps and feeling hopeless about things when I was younger, and to the point of taking medication, and it's a reactive, and I tell young people this. I spoke to 400 bright-eyed 16-year-olds at the Byron Bay Writers Festival the other day, and boy, did they come straight for, you know, the general question is, how do you stay optimistic when you look at what's going on in the world at the moment?
Well, it's a fair question, isn't it? When you do look at what's going on in the world at the moment, you've got children contracting polio in Syria and a very desperate situation in Gaza and a shocking situation with the Sudanese civil war and the Ukraine means that we can't, you know, deliver people's remains to their loved ones. I mean, it's a pretty vile world to feel optimistic about at times.
Yes, and these things, though, come from human behaviour. And there's also enormously inspiring components of human behaviour. But what I do know is, going back to Russell, is that if the compassionate, good-hearted people get knocked out by looking at these terrible circumstances and what Russell also called the unnecessary cruelty of human behaviour, then things will go from bad to worse. We need intelligent, far-sighted, warm-hearted, compassionate people taking over. And that's the big question mark, I think, for the whole of humanity. We've got a shared destiny now. We're 7 billion people, the largest marauding herd of mammals ever on the face of the planet. We're overusing the ability of the planet to provide resources, but if we use our God-given intelligence, we can draw ourselves back in line. But we can't do it if it's everybody for themselves. We have to see ourselves as a community, and that's why I'm very strongly in favour of global democracy, because the alternative is plutocracy, ruled by the rich. We've got that at the moment, and of course the rich want to hang on to that, and we've got to change that and have a recognise that the planet's future depends, this marvellous thing that's happened in the universe, so far as we know, the only planet amongst trillions which has got life on it, consciousness, awareness, intelligence, and the ability to alter the biosphere, and that last bit's the danger, and we've got to sensibly restrain ourselves so that we make the biosphere, keep it.
But I do wonder what a Green would say about the human propensity for war, given the scale of the conflicts in the war right now. You just mentioned the word God-given, and you cheekily describe faith in this memoir as the putty patching up the black hole of pointlessness. Would you say that you have a faith today?
Look, I've chosen to have faith that human intelligence and good-heartedness can win out over the despair that comes from thinking that we're just a bad lot and we're going to go to self-extinction. We don't know where the future is taking us, Natasha, and I'm one for buoying up the better side, to be very simplistic about it, of human nature, because we've got many, look at the suffragettes. They went through terrible agonies, but and they didn't see the realisation of full suffrage, which didn't come to the UK until the early 1930s, because the First World War intervened. And yet they were onto something that was inevitable. And I think us living together as a human community that is dedicated to making the world a better place for those who come after us so that they can enjoy the joyride into the future, and that means into the wider universe, is extraordinarily important. I get bashed around the head in the Murdoch media, for example, for talking about such things, but scientists do, and we all do, and kids love talking about it too. What is our place in the universe? What is the controlling factors on our future? And to me, it's human nature itself, and the better side of that will get us through into a long-term, sustainable and very uplifting future for humanity. But if we just simply allow it to the venal, the greedy, the small-minded and the short-sighted, we're not going to. And I'm plunking for the first.
Bob Brown is my guest this morning on Life Matters here on RN. He's written a series of vignettes from his life, really, a memoir called Optimism. Bob, in 2005, Julia Gillard described you as pretty much the most calculating politician in Canberra. And she said, he's not an archangel of moral force. He's a bloke who wakes up every day and says, how can I chisel a bit of political advantage today? Is that how you were? Heart and compassion, but yeah, strategy
political gameplay. Well, of course, because otherwise the hard-headers, the hard-hearted chiselers, just there for self-advantage, win out. So you don't have to abandon your good heart to be a good strategist. And I've part dedicated this book, besides Rosaria Godoy, the woman who was executed with her baby by the right-wing hit squads in Guatemala. But what a inspiration she is to me all the way down the line. I've dedicated this to Ben Oquist, who was my chief of staff and who's still very active in doing good things in the political arena from outside the Greens, because he was a consummate strategist.
Well, I think he's also advising Clive Palmer, of all people, now. Doesn't that strike you as more than a little odd?
No, because one of the things, while Tony Abbott's been setting fire to the House off climate change policy, which the Greens, with Julia Gillard, got through in the last period of government, Ben's been there with the removalist van at the back door saving the furniture, including what Tony Abbott called the Bob Brown Bank, that $10 billion renewable energy fund, which is so important to this country moving away from burning dirty fossil fuels to a clean renewable energy future and all the jobs and economic well-being that goes with it. And he's been a good friend. I first met him at a forest blockade in Tasmania, and we think very similarly. But he had a strategic nous that I lacked, and this was a very good compliment to my wish to change things for the better in politics, and I'm forever grateful for that.
You've mentioned Tony Abbott, and I was struck that you wrote, I've never met a person in whom I did not see myself reflected. And so I wonder, do you see Tony Abbott reflecting back at you in this way?
Oh, of course.
How?
You know, well, while I might disagree very much with his policies, he wants to be a good Prime Minister. He wants to be remembered for doing the right thing. He said to me, as I say, when I first met him, after he became leader of the then opposition in 2010, Bob, I am an environmentalist. And he's since told a crowd in Victoria at a public seminar, I'm every much the environmentalist that Bob Brown is. Now, we know that that's not so, or I hope not, otherwise I've got to brush up on my environmentalism. But, you know, whatever it is that's going on in his very different line of thinking to me, he wants to do the best he can. I think he's wrong about it. He'll think I'm wrong about it. But the beautiful thing about democracy is people get the opportunity every 3 years to vote us in or vote us out. I never became minister for anything in my political career. And maybe
Do you regret that?
No, not at all. No, I would regret it if I'd sold out on my beliefs at some stage or other to get that advantage. Not that people necessarily have to do that. I think that's something for the future. I think the Greens are. I notice now.
Well, Julia called you a party of protest, not a party of government.
Yeah, but you know, when it came, yes, she did, and that's how she saw it. But I've got a great regard for Julia Gillard. I was first to talk out about the sexism that I think was used so unfairly against her during that 2010 election campaign. And I have to say that in my negotiations with her, her word was good. It was kept. She was a consummate negotiator, and good things came of that. And when we struck that arrangement in 2010, she carried through with almost all the things that were there, and a lot of those are going to survive into the future. And I think she's going to be regarded very well, not only as the first female Prime Minister in Australia, but as an innovator. Boy, did she get a bad press. But history tends to look beyond that, and I think she'll be regarded much more highly than some of those epithets that have been flung at her by right-wing commentators who simply don't have the depth of thought or concern that I think Julia Gillard's got for this country.
You've had many of the same sorts of things flung at you over the years. You've been called many names, often straight to your face, or screamed at you from passing cars. Faggot, the oddball of the Senate, barking mad. I mean, people have been very angry at you and some of your policies over the years. Those whose lives might depend on logging or paper mills or fossil fuels, who have invested their lives and communities in those industries. How have you reconciled with those expressions of rage?
Well, when you get close to, I haven't found the logger yet that I haven't got close, when I've got close to, has said they're worried about what the destruction of the bush, particularly in this age of industrial logging. And, you know, the new Liberal government in Tasmania is about to put through laws which mean mandatory sentencing of $5,000 for getting in the way of a chainsaw going to wreck an ancient forest, and second time round, 3 months jail. We're seeing this extraordinary testing of whether humanity is going to stand up for the natural planet upon which we depend and its biosphere, or whether the short-term wreckers are going to win out. And I'm, as I say in the book, I'll be there in defence of the forest. If they're going to make it mandatory 3 months in jail, well, so be it. We've got to be able to look our grandkids in the eye and say, we thought of you. This is the key to it, Natasha, that the question in everything we do, will people 100 years from now thank us for doing this? And they're not going to thank the people who slaughtered the whales or who destroyed more of the forests or who wrecked farmland for coal seam gas in short term or dug it up for coal to burn and make the world a hotter and less arable place. So it's up to ourselves.
But many of the people involved in those industries, and you know this well, have livelihoods to maintain. And so they're hugely invested in these industries. It's not just the big power players. It's the small people who are eking out an existence. And so I wonder how you've responded to their needs, their plea for compassion.
Yeah, by providing more jobs than the old industries, which are highly automated and have been job-shedding. I mean, the Tasmanian logging industry shed 5,000 jobs in the last couple of decades, not due to environmentalism, but due to this huge conversion, shutting down of small sawmills and conversion to mass wood chipping for paper-making and energy-making in Japan. However, the tourism and hospitality industry in Tasmania, depending on its global fame for the Wilderness World Heritage area, is fast growing. It employs thousands more people than the logging industry, and they're long-term secure jobs. And as I said earlier, the Franklin River is now classed as the top whitewater adventure in the world. And the Tarkine, which is being mined at the moment and isn't protected from mining, has been voted by one American outlet as the most desirable place to go on the planet. There's many more jobs in keeping it. Look at the Barrier Reef, threatened by coal mining directly because it's climate change that's coming to clobber it. It employs more people than the coal mining industry, and it's a $6 billion turnover business stimulator, small businesses, and it is the Barrier Reef is half wrecked, and some people say it will be like Carthage, just a pile of wreckage by the end of this century due to coal mining. Now, is that a wise industry to be promoting? There's a challenge to Clive Palmer as well as to Tony Abbott. Wrong way, go back. That's not good for jobs, not good for the economy, and certainly not good for the environment.
And they would contest that, no doubt. In the last few minutes...
Of course they will.
In the last few minutes we have together, though, most people would go through their lives, Bob Brown, lucky to notice the resident blackbird, and the closest thing they'll get to thinking about another species is their pet. What is it that connected you to the lives of other species and to the natural world? Because this, you know, you write extremely affectionately about your home, your little white cottage there in Tassie. Where did this stem from?
Well, a bit nature and a bit nurture. My mum was, she didn't know it, but she was very close to nature. She grew up in the bush near Glen Innes in northern New South Wales after being born in Adaminaby, and she instilled that into me and my brothers and sisters. But I think you're not quite right there. I think that everybody wants, I make this point, we hand flowers to each other, not chainsaws, as an indication of love and devotion. Now, why do we do that? Because we're bonded to nature. We all like to watch David Attenborough.
Giving me a chainsaw and expressing their undying love to me.
Yeah, but we give wilderness flowers, and it's because nature inspires us. It's the basis of our creativity and adventure, and yet it's disappearing at the greatest rate in all of human history. And I'm an advocate for keeping it because
disappearing from us. We're disappearing from it. I mean, you know,
that's true.
People don't place themselves in it much.
Well, we depend on it. You know, the biosphere can do without us, but we can't do without it. And this is a big challenge for humanity. And one of the reasons I'm a bird out of the cage from the Senate is that I can devote the time I have that nature's going to give me on this planet to helping to encourage those people, and I run into them all the time. I was in Geelong last night where people locally in two directions are trying to stop coal mines opening up in their vicinity, and I totally encourage them to make that stand for the biosphere. People have, I think everybody's imbued with this love of nature. And it's up to ourselves in our own ways to make a stand on it. And I think, I know future generations would be wanting us to do that and applauding people who do make that stand. So we can have a very prosperous, exciting and comfortable life without wrecking what's left of the natural fabric of this planet. And that's something I give my time to. And indeed, I find the response from youngsters about that, their inherent love of nature, is just brilliant. And if there's one thing that heartens this ageing heart of mine, it's that glisten in the eye of young people when you say you can be out there helping keep the beauty of this planet against needless destruction, which is going on at the moment.
Well, you're an optimist. You also, I learned a new word in your memoir, opsimath. Didn't know what that was.
Yeah, learning as we get older. And an important thing there, the Dalai Lama was asked by a 14-year-old in Adelaide, I was there 2 years ago, what's the most important thing, Your Holiness, that a young person can have? And he took her hand and leant over and looked her in the eye and said, self-confidence. And that's what I'm about, is giving these lovely, brilliant young Australians and people elsewhere when I see them the self-confidence to defy the bullies and the short-sighted people who have too much say on the planet at the moment, to help make sure we do have a long-term loving and caring and beautiful relationship with this planet. Well, you know, it's so important. It's fundamentally about human happiness. If we can make future generations happy, we'll be happy ourselves.
And we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us today on Life Matters.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And to reflect on that transition from pessimism to optimism. Bob Brown, thank you.
Thanks, Natasha.
Bob Brown, Optimism, Reflections on a Life of Action, is a memoir just out. It's published by Hardy Grant Books. We'll pop details on the Life Matters website. Well, look, just enough time to squeeze in a call from our Friday Life Matters talkback where we talked about Women Against Feminism. Yes, the conversation still continues on our website. Here's a call from Pamela in response with a historical take.
Hello, my name is Pamela Clements. I was really struck by an early comment from a young woman who said that when she is in the lab, she wants to be recognised as a scientist and not as a woman. And it made me think about how far we have come. My mother was one of Australia's earliest female scientists. a graduate from Sydney University in the 1930s. She went to get a job, and with the other young men in her graduating year, she was taken on by Lever and Kitchen. All of the men were put into the labs, but they didn't put my mum in the lab. They didn't know what to do with her because she was a woman. So they put her in the office, and her job was to write labels all day to be put on bolts of wool for sale in stores like David Jones and Myers, which said, guaranteed to wash in Lux. And he had to sign her name, Adeline Clements, BSC. And when she had written however many of the hundreds of these she was required to write per day, she'd tear through them and then she'd rush down to the lab to be with the guys. We've come a very long way, and that young woman who's now in the lab is there in part because of the work of the feminist movement in between and the women pioneers who led the way. And we need to keep a historical perspective on this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Pamela. And our listener feedback line, 02-833-1430. We love hearing from you. Well, next on the program, everyday economics and bedwetting. In fact, we're following up on a comment that was made in a rather tendentious interview last week. And we want to pursue that further. Evidence around treatment for bedwetting. Coming up to the news now on RN. Bye from me.
Hi, Damien Carrick here. Almost 10 years ago, Cameron Doomadgee died in police custody on Palm Island. In response, an angry mob burned down the police station. Lex Wotton, the man convicted of inciting that riot, has just completed his parole and can now speak to the media. He doesn't regret his actions, he has strong, surprising views on policing, and he's also commencing legal action against police. That's on The Law Report, and you can download or stream this program from the RN website.